I call this meeting of the Committee on Public Safety, Finance, and Policy to order. We do have a quorum today. Before we get to our agenda, just a few housekeeping items. Everyone here today should be seated when they are in the hearing room. There will be no standing or sitting in walkways or aisles, and if you need further accommodation, please communicate with our sergeant staff. Signs are not permitted in the hearing room or at the testifiers table. Please leave signs outside. Clapping and other disruptions are not allowed. All of the testifiers who have signed up in advance have been provided with a time limit for testimony, and please adhere to these limits. I really don't want to cut anybody off. There are limits there so that we can keep the meeting on time and hear from as many people as possible. A special thank you to our sergeant's office staff and our security staff present for helping maintain decorum in the committee hearing room. Members, as you know, we have 5 bills on the agenda. Thank you to everybody who has submitted written letters. The committee materials are posted online, and there are limited copies for the public at the front entrance. The first order of business today is to approve last meeting's minutes. Vice Chair Feist, may I have a motion to approve the minutes for February 18th, 2026?
So moved.
Vice Chair Feist moves approval of the minutes for February 18, 2026. Any discussion? Hearing none, all those in favor signify by saying aye.
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 Opposed? The motion prevails and the minutes for February 18th, 2026 are approved. Members, before we start with bill testimony, I just want to make a few comments. Since we adjourned last May, so many terrible acts of gun violence have happened in Minnesota. I want us to take a moment to acknowledge all of those who were lost to gun violence during the interim, including Mark and Melissa Hortman, Gregory Sweeten, the victim who was killed by a weapon of war during a mass shooting outside Cristo Rey Jesuit High School on the afternoon of August 26th, Harper Moiske and Fletcher Merkel, who were killed the next day while praying at Annunciation School Mass, and Renee Good and Alex Preddy, who were shot and killed by masked federal agents during Operation Metro Surge. There have been countless other victims in all of these shootings, those with both physical wounds and mental wounds. These senseless acts of gun violence have created unspeakable loss and trauma for our communities. We always hope to have bipartisan support for our bills, especially the ones we are hearing today that we know the majority of Minnesotans support. And as the Annunciation families just said in their sing-along that they had in the Capitol Rotundas, they hold each and every one of us in hope. While this is a lot of to cover in one hearing, we felt that on our first day with the gavel that it was important to fight for these bills which address head-on some of the tragic events that happened recently in Minnesota. And with that, members, we are going to move to House File 3433 and House File 3402. We'll be taking testimony on both of the bills together. After we hear from the bill authors and testifiers, we'll move to member discussion. We've allotted 10 minutes for each side to present testimony. And I see that Representative Greenman and Tabke are at the table. And I'm not sure who is going first.
Madam Chair.
Representative Greenman.
I will go first. And I have... Madam Chair, I will go first with House File 3533, and I have an author's amendment.
We're going to do the amendment later. Okay. We're going to just do the descriptions now of the bill and the testifiers, and we'll do your amendment after with that.
Great. Thank you, Madam Chair. House File 3433 is a bill that bans the sale and possession of a class of assault weapons designed for warfare that have inflicted so much pain in my community, in our state, and in our country. It's been nearly 6 months since 116 bullets ripped through Annunciation School Sanctuary as students and teachers, parents, and parishioners gathered for the first mass of the year. 2 terrifying minutes that killed 2 children, Mike and Jackie's 10-year-old Harper, Jesse and Molly's 8-year-old son Fletcher. Dozens and dozens of elementary and middle school kids have serious physical injuries, including Brittany's 6-year-old David, and Harry and Leah's now 13-year-old Lydia, and every student, teacher, clergy, and parishioner who will now have to deal with a lifetime of trauma from the horror they've experienced. On August 27th, my community joined so many other communities around the state and the country that have been shattered by gun violence, injuries, and fear inflicted by these military-style weapons. And they and you join a long line of brave survivors of gun violence who, in your grief, have found determination and courage to raise your voice and tell your stories to end this epidemic that no family should have to go through, and you're here to make sure that they don't. These families in my community are not alone. 69% of Minnesotans support banning these assault weapons. They are with them. So are the students, the teachers, the doctors, the nurses, the local leaders, and the parents. So many parents who've been pleading with us to do what we know works now to save more lives. And sometimes this bill, the politics under the dorm people say are hard, but for most Minnesotans, it's simple. The bill bans the sale and possession of the enumerated semi-automatic military-style weapons and weapons like them with a detachable magazine and one or more military-style features that increase lethality and concealability. It allows Minnesotans who possess these guns now to continue to possess them with a certification process that will be run through the BCA. These assault weapons were designed for the military to effectively kill as many people as possible as quickly as possible on the battlefield. And assault weapons are doing that. They're doing what they're designed to do. But in our schools, our grocery stores, our concerts, our workplaces, and on August 27th in the sanctuary of a church. There is so much we need to do to end this epidemic of gun violence, and we are doing that. And that starts with getting these weapons of war off our streets. We don't have to live this way, and we can't become numb to these mass shootings. This morning, Lydia Kaiser bravely shared her story and called on us to act. She said, "All children have the right to live free from gun violence. Elected officials have to do a duty to protect us from guns." This is going to be a tough hearing of unspeakable tragedy, and I am in awe of the Minnesotans who came to share their stories. And as lawmakers, as the people with the power to change in the state of Minnesota, we owe them our attention and our compassion, and most importantly, our willingness to act. Because as the Annunciation families say, when we pray, we move our feet. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you. Representative Tabke.
Thank you very much, Chair Moeller. It's an honor to carry this bill on behalf of my constituents in Shakopee, who very much believe that we as state legislators must act on gun safety in our communities, that we hear that loud and clear every day. We're going to hear that loud and clear today from families who've been affected by gun violence in, as a parent, horrible, terrifying ways that will never leave and should never leave any of us. And so I'm carrying the high capacity magazine ban, which would ban capacities larger than 10 throughout the state of Minnesota. And with that, the goal is to make this bill as easy for people to say yes as possible. Have been trying to work together with Republican colleagues in getting to a yes on this bill, and we'll hope to get there today, and we'll continue to work on this because it is critical that we support our kids, that we support our families, and we find ways to get to yes on these types of bills where we may very much disagree, but need to get things done for the best possible outcomes for our community. So I look forward to conversation today and discussion about how we can move these things forward and moving on from there. So thank you very much, everybody, for the discussion today, and especially again to the parents and families being here and sharing their stories.
Thank you. Now we'll move to the testifiers, and we will be following the order on the agenda that's been distributed. So we'll begin with Mike Moiski and Jackie Flavin. If you want to make your way to the testifier table, and when you begin, if you can state your name for our record, go ahead. They'll make room for you, I'm certain.
Uh, My name is Jackie Flavin.
Mike Moiske.
Okay. Chair and members, we'd like to start by asking what brought you here today to public service? What brought you to public service in general? What do you hope to protect? When you first said yes to this role, who were you picturing? I'd like you to remember them if you can. In the months since August, we've sat down with many of you, Republicans and Democrats, rural and urban, people from all over. And when we sit down as people, not positions, something really starts to shift. Because there's something so special about Minnesota. We're a purple state that's beautiful. We're a place where people still try to figure it out together. And we're really proud to live here and raise our children here, despite all that's happened. We literally just bought a house four blocks down from our old house. Like, we're staying here. We believe in Minnesota. But I need you to understand something. Parents in our community don't sleep all the way through the night anymore. Because when we send our children out into the world, we know that there are weapons out there capable of turning an ordinary morning into something unthinkable in seconds. On August 27th, we sent Harper to school. Less than 30 minutes later, a deeply unwell person carrying three legally purchased firearms opened fire on that church for 2 full minutes. 116 rounds. Harper yelled, "Get down," to her little buddy, and then she was fatally shot in the head and the neck. There is a sound that comes out of a parent when their child dies. It's not a cry or a scream. It's something older than language. It is so guttural and dark that it breaks everyone who hears it. It is not a sound you forget or ever recover from, and it's a sound that will live with us for the rest of our lives. I don't want you or anyone you know or anyone in general to ever hear it, but your decisions shape whether other parents will ever make that sound. I need to speak plainly about that weapon. The AR-style rifle is engineered for maximum tissue destruction. The rounds travel at such high velocity that they create catastrophic shockwaves, a blast effect that tears through tissue well beyond the bullet's intended direct path. This is not like other guns. The damage to Harper's body was so severe, we were not allowed to see her, hold her, or be with her body ever again. And then, months later, as the pews were removed from that church, more of her remains were found. We had to cremate our daughter a second time. Imagine receiving that phone call. And then tell me, what is this gun for? Hunting? There are other tools. Home defense? There are other tools. What is this one for? Our community already had our school shooting, so why am I here today? Because I don't want this story to become yours. I don't want you to hear the cries that we've had to hear. You stepped into public service for a reason. So right now, the question in front of you is quite simple. What kind of state are we going to be? One where weapons designed to destroy human bodies at scale are treated like ordinary consumer goods? Or one where protecting children outranks hobbies or old habits and convenience? We regulate explosives, pharmaceuticals, and cars because when something can harm at scale, we treat it differently. Why? I'm still waiting for someone to explain why a weapon capable of this level of destruction belongs in ordinary civilian life. I haven't heard an answer that holds up yet, and many Minnesotans, 69%, are asking the same question. We can't fix everything overnight, but we can decide what kind of firepower is normal in civilian life. We can decide that some things are simply too destructive to be casual. Minnesota can be brave. Before you vote, out of respect for what happened in Minnesota that day, please remember three sounds. The sound of 2 full minutes of gunfire echoing through a sacred space where children tried to hide. The sound of hearts breaking with grief so deep that it changes the lives of everyone around it. And the sound of us singing together, because before we walked into this room, we gathered and we sang. Carry those three sounds with you when you vote, the gunfire, the breaking, and the singing. And decide which one you want echoing across Minnesota. Thank you for leading when it's hard.
Thank you for your testimony and our deepest sympathies and appreciation for you being here today. Next, we have Harry Kaiser. Please remember to state your name, too, before you begin. Welcome.
My name is Harry Kaiser. Madam Chair and members, I am the gym teacher at Annunciation. I taught Harper and Fletcher, and I teach all the tough students who survived August 27th. I have been waiting 6 months to come here as a parent and a Minnesotan to share my story to support HF3402 and HF3433. What harrowing detail can I add that will change your heart? When the shooting started, I jumped on the students next to me, but very soon I locked eyes with my eighth grader, Lydia. Her face was bloody, and she said, "Dad, my head." Grateful she was talking and standing, I decided I had to try to get her help. As she made her way toward me, I prayed, "God, don't let me see her get shot again right in front of me." The AR round that hit Lydia's head necessitated an aggressive, invasive surgery. I would do it all over again because I was with Lydia. I could comfort her and be sure that she was okay, unlike so many panicked Annunciation parents who had to pray that day that their child survived, let alone the parents who lost their children. I support these bills. At the very least, we must slow down the next school shooter or anyone hell-bent on taking out a lot of people before killing themselves. The stated goal of the Annunciation shooter was to kill as many little kids as fast as possible. The shooter was able to fire 116 rounds on August 27th, killing Harper and Fletcher and physically injuring over 30 others to set aside all of their mental anguish. Even though it seemed like an eternity, it was all over in 2.5 minutes. There's an opportunity here to slow down the carnage between that first shot and the approach of the first responder. While we work on addressing the problems that caused these young people to want to commit mass murder in the first place, we can save lives right now by saying that in Minnesota, you cannot buy weapons that fire with the speed and destructiveness that only belong in war. Also, your magazine has 10 rounds max, so reloading might make that tiny time window less lethal. I think I got Lydia out of the sanctuary during the quiet of a reload. I owe it to the whole Annunciation community to try to actually get something done this time. It's not just the guns, but it's the guns. Public opinion is on our side. Won't you be glad to be able to say that before the next mass shooter fires into your crowd or your kid's school, that Minnesota decided we've had enough of assault weapons? This time, we are not just moving on. Thank you.
Thank you for your testimony and for Lydia's courage, too, in being here today. Brittany Haig is up next. Please introduce yourself and begin. Welcome to the committee.
My name is Brittany Haig, Chair Mueller, members of the committee, Representatives Tapke and Greenman. Thank you for having us here today. August 27th will forever mark a before and after in my family's life. I've spoken about that day before. Today, I want to focus on what life looks like 6 months after my six-year-old son became the youngest injured survivor of a school shooting in United States history. And that story starts with who David is. David is joy. He was laughing before he was 2 months old. I have the video to prove it. Ask anyone who knows him, and hilarious will be the first word they will use. No first grader has any right to be as good at impressions as David is. He loves riding his bike. He builds fairy houses by the lake. He loves school. Those are hard things to say in the present tense, because they're still there, but they are buried. Because David was shot twice in the head, leaving shrapnel embedded in his skull. He was shot in the abdomen, leaving fragments embedded in his spleen. Bullets fired from an AR-15 ricocheted off church pews and tore into both of his calves, his abdomen, his chest, his left shoulder, his arm, and his back, scattering fragments throughout his body. There's an understanding broadly that emotionally and psychologically our family has not recovered, but at 6 months, people look for a recovery story. They look for resiliency. We are often prompted to reassure them he's still scared, but physically he's doing well. The truth is, he isn't. Recovery from these weapons is not quick. It is not linear. It is not one surgery and a scar. It is ongoing, invasive, and uncertain. We are navigating a path with no clear end point. Since January 1st alone, my first grader has had 18 therapy sessions, 2 sleep therapy sessions, 1 appointment with his sleep pediatrician, 2 medication management visits, 5 occupational therapy sessions, 2 neurology appointments, 2 physical therapy appointments, 1 lab appointment, 1 visit to plan for future CT scans, 1 visit to manage feeding, 1 for sleep, 1 for anxiety, and 1 for his elevated lead levels. Hours in waiting rooms, hours in therapy, hours spent talking about nightmares and panic and lead mitigation instead of spelling words and riding bikes. Because he was shot with a high-velocity weapon, firing ammunition containing lead, we are now monitoring the rising levels in his blood. We are facing the possibility of additional surgeries, not to repair what was done that day, but to prevent further damage from fragments that are poisoning his body as we speak. This is what 6 months look like. It is not a clean recovery. It is not closure. It is a child who still carries pieces of a weapon inside of him. Pieces of ammunition our state has recognized as harmful to wildlife because lead contamination is bad for the environment. And yet those fragments remain in my son. When you discuss policy when you discuss policy about our children, I am asking you to move beyond your rehearsed positions. I am asking you to step away from talking points and remember the children for whom this policy is not abstract. The families who live this reality every day and deserve genuine consideration and discussion for the cost you are asking us to bear. The cost in time, in childhood, in our family's sense of safety. These decisions are complex. I recognize that. I respect that. But complexity should not prevent honest examination. My 6-year-old is living the outcome of each of your decisions. If his body is going to have a conversation, or if this body is going to have a conversation about violence in our society, let it be grounded in reality, not abstraction. Let it be brave enough to be honest and human, because the impact of these weapons does not end when the ambulance leaves. It does not end with a hospital discharge. It does not end when the stitches dissolve. It does not end at 6 months. It will not end at a year. This is our life. It is forever. For some families, it never ends. Please do not forget us. Thank you.
Thank you for your testimony. And just thank you to all the Annunciation families who have shared a horrible day, but also what the aftermath looks like for all of you. with our committee, both with your testimony today, verbally and in writing. We've received many of your letters and emails, and we appreciate that you spent the time sharing that with us. Next, we have Dr. Tim Kumar. Welcome to the committee. Please introduce yourself and begin.
Hi, my name is Dr. Tim Kumar. I'm an emergency physician at Hennepin Healthcare and assistant medical director of Hennepin EMS. I was the first physician on scene at the shooting at Annunciation. Unfortunately, I have been on scene and cared for many victims of gun violence in our community. I'm speaking to you from direct experience treating these injuries and being on scene for these tragedies. I'm here to tell you that the type of weapon directly impacts the severity of these tragedies and the trauma suffered by patients, first responders, and healthcare providers. Over 100 rounds were fired that morning. Not 5 bullets, not 10 bullets, not 15. The type of weapon allowed for that. The type of weapon took injuries that may have been minor and made them life-threatening. A tragedy that could have been one or two victims became a tragedy of more than 20 people shot because of the type of weapon used. These weapons were originally developed for military combat and are capable of causing more casualties, not less, and more destruction of human tissue and bone, not less. I know this because I treat the people they injure. In a tragedy like Annunciation, with so many critically injured patients, our paramedics are trained to care for more than one patient at a time so more patients reach the hospital faster. That morning, our paramedics cared for multiple children in the back of their ambulances as they rushed them to the hospital. Children shot in the head, in the back, in the abdomen, each of them crying out for their parents. That is what maximum casualties and maximum injury looks like. Some will argue that the type of gun does not matter. But unless you have treated these patients firsthand, they cannot truly understand what these weapons do to the body. At a gun range, the hole in a paper target may look similar from a handgun or a high-velocity rifle, but the difference in the human body can be devastating. And if you think this is just my personal opinion, we have submitted a letter signed by the emergency physicians and advanced practice providers of the Department of Emergency Medicine at Hennepin Healthcare, as well as the medical directors of Hennepin EMS. We see these injuries and we support these measures. Today, I have no doubt we will hear about responsible Minnesotans. But my patients, Lydia, who's in the room, is a responsible Minnesotan. The people of Hennepin County, the people of Minnesota are responsible Minnesotans. They have the right to go to school, to go to church, to live in the communities without fear of being shot. I have colleagues in other countries who have never treated a gunshot wound. This level of violence is not normal. Please take meaningful and swift action to limit access to these weapons. Thank you.
Thank you for your testimony and for reminding us the impacts on first responders and others. And again, we have letters that are in the packets from other doctors, nurses, mental health professionals. Next, we're going to move on to the testifiers in opposition. And if I'll call who's on deck so you can both come up at the same time. We've got Rob Doerr and Brian Ghosh. We did go a little bit over, so we'll make sure we have equal time to for your testifiers as well. You know the drill. Welcome back to the committee. Please introduce yourself and begin.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members. I'm Rob Doerr. I'm the president of the Minnesota Gun Owners Law Center. What happened at Annunciation is unthinkable. Families are shattered, and a church and a school were turned into a crime scene. The instinct to act is human. The duty to act wisely is legislative. Proponents often rely on the 94 assault weapons ban as proof that the ban would be effective, but the data tells a different story. When you look at the 94 assault weapons ban, gun homicide rates were already falling before the ban went into place. They did fall over the course of the ban, that's true, but then they continued to fall for an additional 10 years after that, reaching their low in 2014. And while that 10-year period where the gun deaths went down, that same period oversaw a huge increase in the purchases of those previously banned items. The dramatic spike did not come at the end of the ban. That didn't happen until 15 years later during the COVID era. And even then, as it is now, all rifles, so whether you're talking hunting rifles, target rifles, or what you call assault weapons, account for low single digits of homicides in Minnesota every year. Correlation is not causation. This bill is premised entirely on the false presumption that banning something makes it go away. Every time the government has attempted to ban something, broad prohibition of common items, common activities, it does not eliminate those things. It drives them underground, creates a lucrative illicit market, and it only empowers those who are already willing to ignore the law. Criminals don't comply with these laws, and a deranged attacker does not care about the laws that you pass here. But ordinary people do. Ordinary people should not be criminalized for owning ordinary things. And the Supreme Court has repeatedly agreed that these arms, these accessories are in common use, and things that are in common use are protected by the Second Amendment. These measures would face immediate litigation if passed. There are numerous proposals that have been introduced that address the upstream causes of violent attacks and will keep schools safe. Strategies that prevent harm from any threat, not just those from a subset of a particular weapon. The Annunciation attacker had multiple firearms, multiple magazines, and many of those were not covered by this legislation. The uncomfortable truth is this bill, if it was law, would not have prevented that attack. The best way to honor victims isn't through symbolic prohibition of a particular category of arms, but by preventing the next attack, no matter the weapon, no matter the method, through targeted intervention, early warning systems, and strategies that focus on the individuals who pose a risk. Thank you.
Thank you. Mr. Ghosh, and up next is Mariah Day, if you want to make your way to the table.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the House Public Safety Committee meeting. My name is Brian Ghosh. I'm a lawyer and registered lobbyist of the National Rifle Association. And to piggyback on the previous remarks, focus on the individual and the harm that they seek to do. Currently in Minnesota Code, we have 253B, the civil commitment statutes. It would be worthy of doing a deep dive into those statutes and strengthening them to get people like this off the street and to get them the mental health treatment they need prior to committing these bad acts against other people or themselves. Arguably, the existing process in place could have and should have worked, have already done that. Certainly signs were there where this person should have been getting mental health treatment and involuntarily committed, as the case may be, so that this tragedy never happened. This is a very expansive AR-15 AK platform ban on a very commonly owned firearm across the country, including Minnesota. And the high capacity magazines, the so-called, that's a new definition that would be in Minnesota law. There are hundreds of thousands and millions across the country of these, almost a billion of them have been sold and acquired, and you would be eliminating something that is commonly used. So in the Heller case, U.S. Supreme Court case, they talk about that test. If it's in common use, you can't ban it. Now, there's been litigation across the country. There'll continue to be litigation. The U.S. Supreme Court has hinted at taking this up in the next term or two. To decide this case, I think we'd be wise to let the Supreme Court make the law of the land instead of getting ahead of that. There was a 10-year ban on so-called assault rifles in America. That was from 1994 to 2004. You heard reference to that. That they did conclude that that did not have an effect of reducing crime or murders. Subsequent research conducted by the RAND Corporation found no conclusive evidence that banning so-called assault weapons or large capacity magazines had an effect on mass shootings or violent crime. There are some other issues with this bill that are worth noting that haven't been talked about yet. The grandfather clause in the bill that talks about, you know, you heard the proponent say, well, you can, if you have one, you can keep one. Well, can you? And can you use it? Like Minnesotans have grown to use these. This in common use in Minnesota. A rich history of hunting and shooting sports and a growing shooting sports in high school and college. And for hunting and for varmint hunting that's currently being used now, you wouldn't be able to use it for some of those, in some of those ways. And it'd be harder for self-defense. The individual under the grandfather clause would have to register with the BCA. Bureau of Criminal Apprehension and with their local law enforcement. It doesn't state what that application would look like or how much it would cost, but there will be a fee. They can charge a fee for that. It has to be renewed every 3 years. There's also no reference to what that's going to cost or what the reapplication process would look like. There are safe storage requirements for this device if you're allowed to keep it, if you own one prior to January 1st, 2027. But the bill doesn't say what those would be, but it does say you have to have, you're open to inspection by the local law enforcement. You can only possess the device on property owned by the individual or controlled by the individual, and you have to report a lost or stolen one within 48 hours. And you can't buy additional ammunition for that firearm that we were told you're allowed to keep and continue to use, but not really, right? And there's no allowances for using it for hunting. My youngest son has been deer hunting since he was 12. And he's used a suppressed AR every year, and he's gotten a deer. Clearly, that is a legitimate purpose for this type of firearm. And again, just to conclude and remind you that there is ongoing litigation now. There's different decisions coming out based on what circuit you're in, and ultimately the United States Supreme Court is going to decide this for us, and will let us know exactly what's going to be allowed and what's not going to be allowed. So with that, Madam Chair, I'd stand down.
Thank you. Next, we have Mr. Day, and then Anna Leamy, if you want to make your way to the table. And I apologize, I'm mispronouncing people's names that I've met before, and so I'm sorry about that. Please introduce yourself and begin.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mariah Day, and I represent the National Shooting Sports Foundation. NSSF is the trade association for the firearms and shooting sports industry. For more than 50 years, NSSF has encouraged gun owners to safely handle and securely store firearms, and we provide free firearm safety kits and other resources through Project Child Safe. You have my written testimony, so I will try not to belabor those points, but these bills would make it illegal under state law to buy or own the most popular firearms in America, as well as standard capacity magazines. Even if an individual were to go through the process to get a certificate of ownership under the first bill, they would no longer be able to sell their firearm, even to an FFL, if they no longer wanted it. And they would be prohibited from using it for hunting any leased or public access land. More than 32 million modern sporting rifles are in circulation in the U.S. That's more than there are Ford F-150s on the road today. NSSF compiled a survey, a report surveying 30-plus years of detachable magazine production and distribution, demonstrating that of the conservatively estimated 963.7 million detachable magazines supplied from a firearm manufacturer and in the aftermarket, at least 717.9 million have a capacity exceeding 10 rounds. The consumer market totals of rifle magazines not included with the firearm at sale show 30-plus capacity magazines over 413 million, that's over 30 times the amount available of 10 rounds or below in capacity, which is about 13 million. Detachable magazines with a capacity exceeding 10 rounds are the overwhelming standard for law-abiding firearm owners in the U.S. All nine justices of the U.S. Supreme Court agreed with an opinion written by Justice Kagan acknowledging that AR-15s are, quote, widely legal and bought by many ordinary citizens, end quote, and are, quote, the most popular rifle in the country, end quote. Banning these firearms, as this bill proposes, and the magazines, is a direct violation of the Second Amendment as interpreted by the U.S. Supreme Court. The firearm industry welcomes the opportunity to be part of a respectful and constructive dialogue on this important topic, but we would urge you to oppose these bills. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you. Next, Ms. Leamy.
Madam Chair and members of this committee, thank you. My name is Anna Leamy, Director of Government Relations and Advocacy for the Minnesota Gun Owners Caucus. We grieve with the families and the entire Annunciation community. Nothing we say here today diminishes that loss. The question before you is whether House File 3402 and House File 3433 will prevent the next attack, or whether they create new constitutional problems without delivering measurable safety gains. I would also like to address Governor Walz's comments that only the gun industry is testifying here today. We had national experts and everyday Minnesotans who were denied both the ability to speak here today as well as submitting written testimony over technicalities such as hyperlinks in their documents. One of these experts, Amy Swear, who was denied testimony, is here today with physical copies of her testimony full of data and facts available for you all. House File 3402 and House File 3433 also are a policy mismatch. Minnesota's 2024 homicide data shows 170 criminal homicide victims statewide. Rifles, all rifles, whether for hunting, target practice, or what you call an assault weapon, were used in three of those cases. Rifle homicides are rare. Annunciation itself involved multiple firearms, a rifle, a shotgun, and two handguns. Targeting one style of firearm solely based on cosmetic and ergonomic factors does not remove intent or prevent substitution. The deadliest attack on a school in our nation's history was not done with a firearm, it was done with a bomb. And the deadliest school shooting was done with two handguns, not a rifle. Even if prohibition somehow eliminated the things you're trying to ban, it would not keep our kids safe. Our communities deserve better than the partisan symbolic measures offered here today. We can invest in measures that have broad bipartisan support, measures that intervene upstream long before any form of danger manifests. We respectfully urge you to oppose House File 3402 and House File 3433 and pursue solutions that are constitutional, practical, and demonstrably effective. Thank you.
Thanks for your testimony. And just for the record, the idea that there were some technicalities that didn't allow for letters to get submitted, I really resent that. These are the letters in opposition. These are the letters in support. My staff has worked around the clock over the weekend to make sure that these all got in there. It says very clearly on the website that hyperlinks aren't allowed and that PDFs should be submitted. So just to be clear. And we did have a little less time on your side than ours. And so the person that you mentioned, I'd be glad to have her testify right now if she has 2 minutes of testimony. And I don't remember who, Amy, I don't remember her name. So she can come up. And we did offer the other side to give us a list of names. And so we obviously, I'm sure every Annunciation family would have wanted the opportunity to testify here today as well. And so we gave the other side an opportunity for names. Please welcome to the committee, introduce yourself and begin your testimony.
Hi, thank you so much. My name is Amy Swear. I'm a senior legal fellow at Advancing American Freedom. Let me start by saying the obvious thing in the room. In my 10 years of doing public policy on firearms, I have yet to meet a single person who is not on the same page that what happened at Annunciation, that what happened at many places around this country, that these mass shootings are horrific. No child deserves to go to school feeling as though they are unsafe, and no parent should ever have to go through what these parents who have testified today have gone through. And this is such a significant issue that we need to actually tell them the truth and be honest with them about reality. And it's a hard truth. And the hard truth is that it would not have mattered one bit whether or not the individual who shot at their children had a pistol grip or not a pistol grip, whether they had a barrel shroud or not a barrel shroud. Because we're under some illusion that by banning pistol grips and barrel shrouds, somehow, when that same caliber of bullet is fired from the same length of barrel with the same muzzle velocity, that this somehow would have caused less carnage or less trauma or made these children any less injured. And it's a lie. It's a lie we continue to repeat. And we not only do that by the sort of delusion that it would have mattered, right? But we do so by then trying to pass laws that would, in return, scapegoat ordinary law-abiding Minnesotans and turn them into felons for possessing these firearms. The reality is the problem at Annunciation was not that this individual had a pistol grip or a barrel shroud. It is that this person, bent on any amount of carnage, had a firearm in the first place. And frankly, when we step back from this and you go through the data on multi-victim shootings in this state, and frankly in every other state, but particularly in this state, as I have done, in the testimony that was rejected for hyperlinks that I would like to point out, there have been submissions on the other side that were accepted with hyperlinks as well and were not rejected for that same technicality. When you go through that data, you see that enunciation is unlike most multi-victim shootings in this state, which are perpetrated by individuals who are not law-abiding gun owners, but who are part of a small subset of repeat violent offenders who continue to get firearms despite being prohibited persons. And as I point out in that testimony, most of these individuals should have been in jail. The reason they weren't in jail was because of policies that allowed them to remain in the public, terrorizing ordinary law-abiding Minnesotans while they should have been in jail. These are things that we have to discuss if we are going to have honest conversations about this, because I agree with prior testimony. This is something that deserves to be grounded in reality. This is something that we have to have these hard conversations about. And so I do appreciate being able to have 2 minutes. I will leave it with this final statement. It is concerning to me that such a serious conversation as this one has been limited to 4 testifiers on each side. It deserves more discussion than that. Thank you.
Thank you. To our knowledge, all hyperlinks had been removed from the documents. People are human and make mistakes. This is an urgent situation that we need to address. If we had agreement to go later into the evening to hear more about that, it would be fine with me. Next, we are going to actually move to the bills. Representative Greenman, would you like to move that House File 3433 be re-referred to the Judiciary, Finance, and Civil Law Committee?
Thank you, Madam Chair. That's my motion.
Representative Greenman, your bill is before us, and you do have an author's amendment. Would you like to move the A3 amendment to get the bill in the shape you'd like to present it in?
I would. Thank you, Madam Chair.
And if you could please explain that amendment to us.
Thank you. The author's amendment is based on language, most of it based on technical guidance from the BCA, clarifying that the certification data is private under the Data Practices Act, and clarifying that the BCA is responsible for certification process and for notifying local law enforcement agencies, that that's the BCA's responsibility, and then some cleanup language that we wanted to include.
Any discussion to the A3 amendment? Seeing none, all those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed? The A3 amendment is adopted. All right, now to the discussion of House File 3433 as amended. Representative Hudson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And this will apply to both the bills that were presented before us here today. So just to frame us in current events, last night Fox 9 reported that police confirmed Monday that they're investigating a double homicide. Suspect is a 24-year-old man who was recently released from jail after making bail on a gun possession and fleeing police case. Shortly after leaving jail, Chief O'Hara says that the suspect went to a family member's home and opened fire, killing 2 people, ages 14 and 23, who are believed to be his cousins. That's what we're dealing with. That's the reality. I appreciate these bills being brought forward today because they give us the opportunity to draw 2 very important contrasts. The first is in how discussion has been taking place in other committees today. In state government finance, we heard the OIG bill, where there was much discussion and concern expressed from the DFL regarding the constitutionality of the language that came over to us from the Senate. In judiciary, we heard a bill from Leader Long establishing a cause of action for people who feel like their constitutional rights have been violated. Again, much concern expressed about constitutional rights and being allegiant to the oaths that we all took when we took our oath of office. And now here we are looking at 2 bills that completely gut the Second Amendment, indescribably. These would both fall to Bruin. They would fall to Heller. And the second contrast is last week in this committee, we listened to members on the other side argue against aggravated sentencing for gun criminals who've been convicted on 3 separate occasions of felonies with a firearm. And then in this very same room earlier today at Finance, DFL argued against funds for physical security upgrades for schools, including non-public schools, such as Annunciation. So I got to say, I'm a little sick and tired of hearing the rhetoric that it's Republicans, and not just Republicans, but anybody who actually values their constitutional right to the ability to protect themselves and their families, that we're the ones who don't want to take action. A little sick of the pretense that taking action can only possibly mean taking away firearms from law-abiding citizens. Under the trifecta, 23 and 24, here's the list of gun control measures that did not prevent the Annunciation shooting. Expanded background checks did not prevent the Annunciation shooting. Extreme risk protection orders, also known as red flag laws, did not prevent the Annunciation shooting. Domestic violence firearm prohibition expansion did not prevent the Annunciation shooting. Binary trigger ban did not prevent the Annunciation shooting. These bills would place Minnesota in the highest tier of gun control alongside states like California, New York, and Illinois. States not exactly known for their lack of gun crime. The best argument against these bills is any given weekend in Chicago. Thank you.
Further member discussion? Representative Duran.
Thank you, Madam Chair. One of the questions I have for you that I was just reading here, would a police officer be in violation of this law if they carry off duty?
Representative Greenman.
Thank you, Madam Chair. If you look at the language that includes the exception for, and I can... Exception. Any government officer, member of the armed forces, or police officer, to the extent that the person is otherwise authorized to acquire or possess a semi-automatic assault weapon, and so does acting within the scope of their duties. So what our language does is say if folks need it for their profession, to, in particularly in this case, to protect Minnesotans, that they can have it. But otherwise, the same rules apply.
Representative Duran.
Thank you. So actually carrying one of these firearms while an officer off duty would actually make them in violation of Minnesota state statute then, because they're not acting within the scope of their job at that time because they'd be off duty, right?
Yeah. Representative Grimman.
Thank you. That's correct. We believe off duty that officers should have the same obligations as other folks.
Representative Duran.
Thank you, Madam Chair. My next question is, I guess we've discussed this multiple times, but I think I just need to hear from you. Are there more mass shootings done by pistols or rifles? Can you clarify that?
Representative Greenman.
I can give you all the data on mass shootings. And what we acknowledge, you listed off, Representative Hudson listed off a set of bills, many of which have saved lives. They do not save every life. We know with our epidemic of gun violence, it is multifaceted. And a lot of the reasons is because we have a lot of guns in our communities, more than any other country in the world. And so when we talk about what we know as the top 10 mass shootings, 9 of them have been with assault weapons that were designed for war, that were designed for maximum casualty, high velocity. And so we can get into all, and I would like to talk about how all of the other ways we are going to talk about safe storage so that we have less handgun deaths. We're going to talk about increasing red flag laws so we actually take care of the folks who should not have these, and we need to do more work on that. But when we talk about mass shootings, it is absolutely in the data that these, as we heard Dr. Kumar say, that in addition to being involved in the most, in the biggest mass shootings, they are also creating more casualties and deaths. And if we can save lives, we will, and that's what this bill does.
President Durant, there are other people on the list. Do you have one more follow-up?
I do.
Go ahead.
Sorry. I just need to clarify this. I mean, the fact that we heard it multiple times and he refused to answer the question, I'm worried here that I guess you're hitting it just because it may look scary. Now, I think I'm the only one in this room that actually has gone to combat and actually carried these weapons of so-called war that you may be talking about. So as far as I know, I didn't carry one of these. So I'm really concerned that we bring up this whole fact of weapons of war, weapons of war, weapons of war. But I've been there. And I didn't carry one of these. So I think we need to be careful with our wording because of the fact that we're just into the fear-mongering aspect of things and not going down to the actual problem we have. More handguns are used in mass shootings than rifles. We know this. It's statistical. You can't get away from it. This is theatrical.
I'll just remind you that in 2 minutes, 116 bullets killed two children and injured a total of approximately 30 children and adults praying in a church. Mm-hmm. Representative Steer.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So do you have any idea how many Minnesotans will be impacted by this law? Do you have a general number?
Representative Greenman.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I have actually been looking, and we have a firearms expert on the data on how many nationally, and I think most of the data comes from the NSSF. It's been produced in court. It's not clear where that data came from, but it sounds like about 5 to 6% of the guns owned are these type of weapons. And I don't know if we have time, but to look to a firearms expert, but we have been looking at that, and my understanding is it's about 6%.
Representative Steer.
All right, just one follow-up question. So what does enforcement look like if this bill passes?
Representative Greenman.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and I appreciate you sending me this question this weekend. As both the certification acknowledges, if folks want to keep their legacy weapon, what they have to do is comply with a safe storage provision that the BCA will lay out, and then and follow that. We have in the amendment we adopted took out the part about inspection, and so I imagine that this will be enforced like our permit to carry and other gun laws that we have in place today.
Representative Steer. Representative Novotny.
Thank you, Chair Mueller. Representative Greenman, the bill is framed in the standing of being against AR-15. And it's a AR-15 bill, but there's this, all the other qualifiers, all the other things that can come in to the bill. That would you agree that pretty much every semi-automatic rifle would be affected by this?
Representative Greenman.
Thank you, Madam Chair. No, if it does not have a detachable magazine over 10 rounds and it doesn't have these features, it would not be affected.
Chair Novotny.
Thank you, Chair. Representative Greenman, one of the most popular starter hunting guns is the Glenfield Model 60. That's a tubular magazine with 18 rounds on a 22 long rifle. Now, there is an exception under the tab key bill that we have coming up next, but that's not included here. So one of the most popular first firearm that people get, this Glenfield Model 60 for squirrel hunting, would be covered under the language of this bill. Which leads me to my next question. Line 5.12 says, possession of the device only on property owned or immediately controlled by the person while engaging in the legal use of the device at a duly licensed fire range or while transporting the item in compliance with applicable law. So not only are we going to outlaw a squirrel gun, my reading of the law is that there's no allowance for hunting at any point that's not on property that you own or immediately controlled by the person. I grew up working in Sherman County. We had the Sherman County Wildlife Refuge. It was very popular for individuals from the cities to come up and squirrel hunt. between the Glenfield Model 60, which was popular, or the Ruger 10/22, which is probably the second most popular squirrel gun. These would all be prohibited, and all semi-automatic firearms by this would be prohibited for hunting. AR-10s and the 308, which I've taken elk hunting, I've taken deer hunting, that would be prohibited. I wouldn't be able to use that anymore. We talked on the other things. And in the truth, the Annunciation shooter had months to prepare. We know that he documented through videos for 3 or 4 months how he was setting up his plan, his angles, how he was going to do this. And I used to listen to a podcast called Garage Logic, and the host of that show, Joe Souchere, used to talk about until there's a super magnet that can magically pick up every gun in the state, bad guys, good guys, cops, military, that he would be against this, because until you have that magic magnet that's going to get every gun, only the bad guys will have guns. And I'm against that. We've had a lot of time. I've had a couple of phone calls. Had a call with the governor right after the Annunciation shooting happened, and we offered to come back in and do a special session and get some common sense staffing, extra protection, security measures that would be something that we could actually do that wouldn't be unconstitutional and that we could have had ready to go fairly quick. But we haven't had that special session, and I never got a call back. This bill would unfairly impact individuals that live in high impact areas or high density areas like the cities, just from the standpoint that they're more likely to have contact with law enforcement. This bill, I think, would most likely not achieve the goals that it's proposed to solve, because there's so many things that they do. What we've seen in all of these school shootings or mass shootings is the one thing they fear when they do their plan is the arrival of the good guy with the gun that will stop them. And the less good guys with guns or gals with guns that are there to stop them, that gives them more time to cause their havoc. As been pointed out by testimony, and we all know this, that this bill would be in conflict with previous Supreme Court decisions. The bill would be unenforceable given the scope and the magnitude of what you're planning to do and how you're planning to do it. And the bill would also make probably over a million. You'd make a million felons out of currently law enforcement following individuals. And with that, I recommend a no vote.
All right, Representative Greenman, your closing remarks.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And just a note on constitutionality, because that's come up. A note, since Bruin, we would be the 12th state. One-third of the population of the United States currently lives in a state that has a ban on assault weapons. Since Bruin, 5 federal appellate courts in the 1st, 2nd, 3rd, 4th, and 7th Circuit have ruled that assault weapons bans have upheld the bans. The Supreme Court just last year had the ability 4 times to take these up. So the idea that it is somehow unconstitutional or untested is just wrong. But I want to leave, because I think that one thing I heard Rob Doerr said is that this is a really human thing. And I'd say that our job is also human. And so I want to leave you with a letter that I actually got this afternoon. And it was to me, but it is entitled Dear Government, which I think it means to all of us, from a 10-year-old, Sophia, from her mother. My name is Sophia, and I'm 10 years old. I go to Annunciation Catholic School. And during church, we went through a shooting. My buddy and me didn't think it was real until we saw Maeve get shot. All I saw was black and blood behind me. Hiding under the pews, we got to the gym. And I think that the gun should not be sold to anyone for reasons Harper and Fletcher died. Please do something to make it right. I'm sorry for not spelling right. Love, Sophia. We need to listen to the people and to the kids. These kids are so clear. Go out and they're saying, choose us, not guns. And we have that choice tonight. So I'd ask for your vote in choosing us, not these weapons that were made for war. And I'd like a roll call, Madam Chair.
All right, a roll call has been requested. Representative Greenman renews the motion to re-refer House File 3433 as amended to the Judiciary, Finance, and Civil Law Committee. The clerk will take the roll.
Chair Mueller.
Aye.
Chair Mueller, aye. Chair Novotny.
No.
Chair Novotny, no. Vice Chair Feist.
Aye.
Vice Chair Feist, aye. Vice Chair Whitty.
No.
Vice Chair Whitty, no. Representative Berg.
Aye.
Representative Berg, aye. Representative Bliss.
No.
Bliss, no. Representative Curran.
Aye.
Representative Curran, aye. Representative Duran.
No.
Representative Duran, no. Representative Ingen.
No.
Representative Ingen, no. Representative Greenman.
Aye.
Representative Greenman, aye. Representative Harder.
No.
Representative Harder, no. Representative Hollins.
Yes, of course.
Representative Hollins, aye. Representative Hudson.
No.
Representative Hudson, no. Representative Johnson.
Aye.
Representative Johnson, aye. Representative Pinto.
Aye.
Representative Pinto, aye. Representative Ream.
Ream, aye.
Representative Ream, aye. Representative Rapinski.
No.
Representative Rapinski, no. Representative Schwartz.
No.
Representative Schwartz, no. Representative Steer.
No.
Representative Steer, no. Representative Tabke.
Aye.
Representative Tabke, aye. There are 10 ayes and 10 nays.
There being 10 ayes and 10 nays, the motion does not prevail. Next, we'll discuss House File 3402. Representative Tabke, would you like to move that House File 3402 be re-referred to the Ways and Means Committee?
Thank you, Chair Mueller. That is my motion.
And you do have an author's amendment. Would you like to move the A1 amendment to get the bill in the shape you desire?
Yes, please, Chair Mueller.
Please describe the A1 amendment.
The A1 amendment changed the felony from 5 years to 2 years.
Any discussion to the amendment? Seeing none, all those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Aye. Opposed? The motion prevails and the A1 amendment is adopted. All right, two-year bill as amended. Chair Tabke.
Thank you very much, Chair Mueller. I don't have a lot to add from the introduction, but what this bill does, just so everyone knows, is it bans large capacity magazines. And so we have that defined here in this bill as 10 rounds is where we're at on this. And it would take effect on July 1, 2026, and would have until July 1 of 2027 in order to dispose, use, modify those magazines. And so that can be done with a block that costs $5 to $7, depending on what type of magazine it is. It can be moved out of state. There are many options for that. And the goal here is to make sure that we are building in a layer of another layer of safety from firearms to make sure that people who are using these, that if we look at the shooting that happened in Las Vegas, it was a 100-round drum that was used there. And we haven't talked a ton about the Annunciation shootings without what the magazines were there, and we're not going to today because that is still under investigation and that is happening currently. With this, we know that there are many, many times this has been utilized and would add a layer of safety so that we can hopefully continue to save more lives.
Thank you. Questions? Questions from the committee. Representative Duran.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Tabke, would this also go along with law enforcement carrying off duty as well? Would that make them a violation of the law?
Correct.
Okay.
Sorry,
Representative Tabke.
Yes.
Representative Duran.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Sorry. So the Glock 17, which is commonly, you know, a common pistol used by all law enforcement officers when they're carrying, you know, on duty. So when they carry off duty, they have to switch their firearm that they're normally trained with and comfortable with in order to abide by this law, right?
Representative Tabke.
Chair Mueller, Representative Duran, yes.
Representative Duran.
I'm in. Thank you.
Okay. Anything else? Chair Novotny.
Thank you, Chair Mohler. Representative Tabke, just want to make sure you're aware that magazines aren't controlled. Referring back to the Annunciation shooter, he had months, as we said, to plan. At any point, he could have got in his car, driven to Hudson. Had he been in total compliance enough in the head, he complied with Representative Greenman's bill and registered his gun, got rid of his large capacity magazines or converted them. There's nothing that would have stopped him from making a 20-minute drive to Hudson and picking up these large capacity magazines, as you call them, in a different state. He had plenty of time to do this. He was going to come up with what he needed to do to fulfill his plan, no matter what. I'd like to point out that the darkest day in my living history was September 11th, 2001, where people with suicidal ideologies, like the Annunciation shooter had, were able to kill over 3,000 people with nothing but box cutters. Or you can use fertilizer and fuel oil and a rented van. This is an unenforceable law. You have no idea how many magazines are out there and how you're going to control it. With that, I recommend that the members vote no.
And before you close, Representative Tabke, I just want to say that I know our members would love to make comments and statements as well, but in the sake of time, I know, I'm so sorry, but in the sake of time, we really wanted to make sure that our colleagues across the aisle had opportunity to question and comment. And so I just don't want the public to think that's a reflection for lack of support for these bills or position, but also it's recognizing the urgency of the moment and the importance of getting these passed. With that, Representative Tabke, if you want to close.
Thank you, Chair Mohler. Now, first, I'll respond to Chair Novotny. Like, I hear what you're saying. I understand what you're saying there, but the fact is that you don't know that. Like, you don't know for sure that this couldn't have helped. You absolutely have no way of knowing that if there had been more pauses, if there had been more pauses under duress, if there had been more pauses in that shooting, that it couldn't have helped. Would it have helped? I don't know. We simply do not know for sure. But do we know that it could have helped? Absolutely. That is something that could have helped in this situation, in many other situations, and for where we're at today, more importantly, in situations yet to come. We know that there will be more mass shootings in the state of Minnesota. We know that there are things that we can and should be doing, and I believe that we're abdicating our responsibility by not taking some reasonable steps in moving forward. So there in the letters that we've gotten, we have it's been shared that this is unprecedented, that this is absolutely beyond the pale of things that that could possibly happen with gun safety. And it is absolutely precedented. There are 14 other states plus the District of Columbia that have magazine limits. And those are working. We know that they're saving lives, and we know that that can continue to help here in Minnesota. So this is not intended to be burdensome. This is not intended to go that direction. That we also have a lot of folks saying that this is unconstitutional. And there is absolutely nothing to say that this is unconstitutional. This is held up in court time and time and time again. And the times that it has been held up in court have dramatically outweighed the number of times it has been pushed back in court. And the Supreme Court has neglected to take this up. And maybe that will happen in the future. I don't know. But I know that we can do something about this today. And so I just ask, I beg for someone to help us with this, because I very much believe this could have helped in the Annunciation shooting, in the assassination of our friends Mark and Melissa. Like, this could have helped. I don't know for a fact that it would have helped, but I know that it could have, and I know that it can help in the future. So I'm just asking for folks to make this is not unconstitutional. It's not unprecedented to make help us with a yes and moving this forward to have additional conversations about it. So thank you very much, everyone, for your support. And with that, I ask for a roll call.
A roll call has been requested. Representative Tabke renews the motion to re-refer House File 3402 as amended to the Ways and Means Committee. The clerk will take the roll.
Chair Mueller.
Aye.
Chair Mueller, aye. Chair Novotny.
No.
Chair Novotny, no. Vice Chair Feist.
Aye.
Vice Chair Feist, aye. Vice Chair Witte.
No.
Vice Chair Witte, no. Representative Berg.
Aye.
Representative Berg, aye. Representative Bliss.
No.
Representative Bliss, no. Representative Curran.
Aye.
Representative Curran, aye. Representative Duran.
No.
Representative Duran, no. Representative Engen.
No.
Representative Engen, no. Representative Greenman.
Aye.
Representative Greenman, aye. Representative Harder.
No.
Representative Harder, no. Representative Hollins.
Aye.
Representative Hollins, aye. Representative Hudson.
No.
Representative Hudson, no. Representative Johnson.
Aye.
Representative Johnson, aye. Representative Pinto.
Aye.
Representative Pinto, aye. Representative Ream.
Ream, aye.
Representative Ream, aye. Representative Rapinski.
No.
Representative Rapinski, no. Representative Schwartz.
No.
Representative Schwartz, no. Representative Steer.
No.
Representative Steer, no. Representative Tabke.
Aye.
Representative Tabke, aye. There are 10 ayes and 10 nays.
There being 10 ayes and 10 nays, the motion does not prevail. Members, we are going to move on to some other bills. Just want everybody to take a deep breath and also recognize that people may be coming and going from the room, and if you can do your best to minimize the outside noise, that's much appreciated. The next bill we have up is House File 3404. This is Representative Cleburne's bill and Representative Bonner's bill. I will move to recommend that House File 3404 be re-referred to the Ways and Means Committee. You do have an author's amendment. I will move the A3 amendment. And would you like to describe what the amendment does? Chair Cleburne.
Yes, we can do that now, or we could do it with the bill itself as we just go through the separate pieces.
Does anybody have any questions about the amendment? All right. We'll go ahead and adopt the amendment now so the bill's in the shape you want. Okay. All those in favor of the A3 signify by saying aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed. The amendment is adopted. And I don't know who's starting, but
I'm starting.
Go ahead, Chair Cleburne.
Yes, thank you. I would just like to thank the committee for taking the time to hear this important bill, 3404. It comes out of the events of June 14th, 2025, but I want to make the committee aware that this bill, having to do with people impersonating themselves as a police officer, is really about two things. It's about protecting the integrity of law enforcement so that citizens in our state feel confident when an officer arrives at their home that they truly are an officer, and it enhances public safety, and that is the purpose of this bill. I would like to thank MPPOA, the Chiefs Association, the Sheriff's Association, and the Municipal Legislative Commission and their 19 member cities for their letters of support of this bill. I would also like to thank the members of this committee who worked with me to get this bill drafted and to make sure that it was in the best possible form for passage. So thank you for that. And with that, I'm going to move to Co-Chair Bonner to introduce, we'll walk through the bill, and then we'll go through them section by section quickly.
Representative Bonner, welcome.
Thank you. I will just briefly say thank you for everyone for hearing this bill. I think, you know, without going into much detail, I think we all know that this bill is highly personal to me. What happened in June, I think, is amplified by the fact that the individuals that came to my door, and that may very well have come to all of our doors, used a position of trust to come and get me to open that door. And so I think this is really important to talk about public safety, but overall, this bill is really important because it speaks to this idea of trust and how we restore that trust in those that we believe in law enforcement. And with that, I will just say, we'll start with section one, the intent to mislead. This particular part starts with that version and adds a felony that may come with a sentence of imprisonment for not more than 2 years or the payment of a fine of not more than $4,000 or both.
In subdivision two, you will see provisions that have an enhanced new felony for whoever violates subdivision one, impersonating an officer with the intent to mislead while committing the following acts: gaining access to a public building, directing or ordering another person to act or refrain from an act, violating the sections of law that have to do with lights and sirens, operating a motor vehicle that is marked to deceive, marked as a police, patrolman, sheriff, deputy, or marked with lettering or insignia that might lead a reasonable person to believe that this is a law enforcement vehicle. So these are prohibitions on marking those vehicles. Also, there is a new provision in law, which is you will find on lines 2.10 to 2.12, that displaying equipment commonly attached to law enforcement vehicles or facsimile of equipment that would reasonably lead a person to believe that the motor vehicle is a law enforcement vehicle is prohibited. And that provision came to us from the Chiefs Association, so I thank him for that.
Subdivision 3 talks about the previous violation, including the possession of a firearm. This specifically comes with 5 years, or within 5 years of a previous violation, is guilty of a felony and may be sentenced to imprisonment for not more than 10 years. It increases the penalty there, or payment of a fine of not more than $20,000 or both. It also then goes on to suggest that if the this violation occurs while in possession of a firearm, we know this came from a couple of our local police departments, that they would be guilty of a felony that may be sentenced to imprisonment of not more than 10 years or a fine of $20,000 or both.
And moving on to subdivision 4, crime committed while impersonating an officer, enhanced penalties. It goes on to say if you commit these crimes, you are guilty, or you may be charged one with both crimes. You will see that on lines 2.30 and 2.31, but also it enhances the penalty provisions. So if you are doing this, if you commit a crime while you are impersonating an officer, the penalties will be increased. And that felony provision may be imprisonment of not more than 3 years or payment of a fine of not more than $15,000 or both. But the important part here is that the imposition of one penalty does not preclude the prosecution under the other provision as well. In with the A3 amendment, which would be the subdivision 5, what we have done is deleted the original language, and we have added the original language had to do with how other people identify. And this changes, the A3 changes it to how Minnesota officers must identify. And I would like to thank Representative Steer for your work on this and Representative Novotny for your work as well. And so what it does is it basically lays out for the public to have confidence in the person who comes to their door. And it pertains to post board officers, federally recognized tribes officers, officers who may come to our state during a hot pursuit, who would be following up, which are legally allowed to do. And it also pertains to emergency management assistant compact officers, so officers that may come here to help us with an emergency. And it makes it very clear that if an officer needs to wear a uniform, a badge, a nameplate, a number, something, so that citizens know and can easily recognize that these are law enforcement officers duly organized under the state of Minnesota or allowed to be here by the state of Minnesota. And it clarifies what combination of those identifiers they need. There's also a provision for plainclothes officers that says they can just state the information or provide a card, which I understand is a standard practice. But nothing in this bill requires an undercover agent to put themselves at risk. So they do not have to identify unless they are actually in the process of detaining someone, making an arrest, or executing a warrant. So they themselves have identified themselves. And then the last thing I want to say, which is really important, is that the failure of a police officer or peace officer to make these identifiers does not contaminate the evidence, and it still allows the arrest to go forward. So we are protecting the trial process as well for the evidence there. And then the last piece.
And then finally, the easy part, of course, the effective date. This section effectively puts the effective date at August 1st of 2026 and applies to crimes committed on or after that date. Essentially, it is forward-looking and not retroactive in nature.
All right. Thank you. Member discussions. Oh, lots of hands here. Representative Whitty.
Thank you, Chair Mueller. Thank you both. Representative Bonner, sorry for what you went through and everybody in this room. We lost a lot. I just want to thank you for how important this is for the community trust and with our law enforcement who are out there working to protect, and this guy stole that day. So thank you. I know your bill is filled at 35. I don't know if you're adding more, but I would be honored to add my name to it. Thank you.
Representative Cleburne.
Yes, I believe that we are going to ask Representative Bonner to clone the bill so that we can have more signatures on the bill and allow for more office, more participation. Thank you.
Thank you. Representative Hudson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I have a relatively boring technical question, but it might be one that's shared by the public. Was there any discussion about making the effective date upon it being signed into law by the governor? I know that has happened sometimes. People who've been here longer than me might be able to let us know why that's not a best practice or if it's just normal to have it be August.
I think I can answer that or maybe call on nonpartisan staff, but I think a lot of times it's just a matter of getting the statute books updated and all of the materials like the charging documents, the electronic charging, everything that goes into criminal penalties and crimes so that people that are actually charging these cases and doing these cases have the right information. But I could stand to be corrected if nonpartisan has a different.
Madam Chair, members, I'd say that's accurate. In addition, the Sentencing Guidelines Commission typically meets after session and has any changes that passed the previous session go into effect on August 1st. So that August 1st date typically lines up with changes to the sentencing guidelines for new offenses.
All right. Chair Novotny.
Chair Mueller, thank you. Representative Cleburne, Representative Viner, thank you for bringing this. This bill is, to me, what bipartisan work in this legislature should be. When someone asks me, you know, about all the terrible things, I will be able to point at this bill and say, yes, there are things that we can work together with and we can hash out some of the concerns that we have and clear them up. So thank you for working with us on this. This, you know, Representative Steer, Representative or Vidal and Whitty and Curran, we've all gone to that door at 3 o'clock in the morning, and it could be simple as, you know, your cows are out or your loved one has been in a car crash and isn't coming home. But in the back of your mind, you're always wondering what happens when you go up to that door and how you're going to be received. And so thank you for doing this. It is a bill based on tragedy, but hopefully it will make things better in the future. And I recommend a yes vote.
Thank you. And I'll express my gratitude as well for your hard work on this and really for taking this for the team, working on this and working across the aisle and with all the associations to get it into the shape that we can get it passed. So thank you for that. Any closing remarks?
I would just like to thank the staff for working with me multiple times and setting up all the Zooms and all of the conversations that have gone in getting this bill put together and for the amazing, amazing knowledge of Penn Johnson. Nonpartisan never fails to disappoint. They know everything. So thank you so much for that. And Kristen, would you like to say anything?
Yeah, I will just add, I think we can all agree in this room that I never imagined that an assassin would come to my door. I never in a million years imagined that doing the job that I love would put my family in harm's way, the children in my care at that time in harm's way. And I continue to struggle with what could have happened differently. 99 situations out of 100 and I would have been home. I would have opened that door and people continually ask me, would you have opened the door? And the honest truth is a 100%. I believed that law enforcement was at my door. I trust my chief. I trust my department. I've been through the Citizens Police Academy and I know many of these officers personally. They are good, decent human beings. I would 100% have trusted in them. And that is what makes this particularly heinous. But I think what I want to say at this point is that because I implicitly trust my chief and my local officers to keep me, my family, and my community safe, last June, that trust was broken by a man attempting to tarnish the good work of law enforcement professionals. This bill is a first step in affirming that these high standards are put in place to restore public trust and to ensure that our neighbors, including my family, can once again feel safe. Thank you.
Thank you. And with that, I renew the motion to recommend that House File 3404 as amended be re-referred to the Ways and Means Committee. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed? The motion prevails. Thank you again. We've still got time, members. So next we're going to move to House File 3412, Representative Finke's bill. And welcome to the committee, Representative Finke. Since you're not a member, I will move to recommend that House File 3412 be placed on the general register. You do not have any amendments, and so your bill is before us. Please go ahead and tell us about your bill.
Thank you, Madam Chair, for hearing this bill. Thank you, members, for your continued attention on this very important day in public safety. This bill, HF 3412, would require law enforcement, local, state, and federal, to not wear masks while they are on duty, with a few exceptions delineated in the bill, including for public health, for undercover officer, or to protect one's face from physical disfigurement. And, you know, I had remarks, but I'm going to change them because I think Representative Witte just spoke beautifully about what importance there is in understanding the public trust between individuals and law enforcement. And we have all just seen 3,000 people come to our state purporting to be law enforcement, wearing no badges, wearing masks, and breaking the public trust for thousands and thousands and thousands of people in the state of Minnesota. We need to know that the people are who they say they are, and this bill would require people to simply do their jobs proudly, showing their faces. I'll turn it over to my testifiers.
All right, thank you. I don't know who's going first. All right, first we have Rain Headland. Welcome to the committee. Please introduce yourself and begin.
Hi, my name is Rain Headland. I live near the Wilmer area here in Minnesota.
Go right ahead. Thank
okay.
You.
On December 14th, a friend and I had heard there was ICE activity in Wilmer, so we decided to go into town in Wilmer and be there in case we needed to observe. We had heard from friends that there may be ICE agents at a local restaurant, so we went to the restaurant, and there we found three large trucks with blacked out windows and Texas license plates. We sat in our vehicle for a while and eventually they came out. We decided that sitting there right next to their vehicles was too close, So we decided to go across the street and observe from there. After a little while, they left the parking lot. We continued to observe them from a safe distance following traffic laws. After a while, the trucks drove towards our law enforcement center, and I talked to my friend who was driving and said, we should pull off towards the Health and Human Services building. So if you go to the right, it's the law enforcement center. If you go to the left, it's the Health and Human Services building, and kind of regroup and talk to people to see what we should continue doing, if we should continue observing or have someone else come observe. And after we turned right or left into the Health and Human Services building, they then circled around and came back and surrounded us and blocked us in, mostly in the Health and Human Services building. They eventually turned on some flashing lights that didn't look like police lights, and two men got out of the vehicle. There was three vehicles blocking us in, and two men got out of the vehicles and began running at my friend's car. She decided to start driving away. There was some flashing lights. They began chasing us on foot, banging on my friend's car. One of the men had a mask on. The other one did not. They were in plain clothes, no vests, no name tags, no badges visible. It seemed like there was they were armed. They had some belts on. And one of the men grabbed my passenger door and pulled so hard on it, it felt like he was going to rip the door open. We had the doors locked. When my friend decided to drive away, I called 911 and got the dispatch on the phone, who instructed us to drive across the street to the local law enforcement building. We parked at the law enforcement building, and the agents blocked us in. We were parked parallel to the building, and they blocked us in, got out of the car, began taking pictures of us. We waited until a sheriff's deputy came out, and they talked to the agent for a moment, and then the agents got in the car and drove back across the street. When the sheriff's deputy came and started asking us questions and we started talking to her, she said, what are you guys doing or what's going on? I said, these men ran up to our cars, began banging on the cars and tried to break the door open. And she said, well, they're federal agents. You need to listen to them. And I said, how am I supposed to know who they are? There's no identification on the vehicles. There's no identification on them, no vest. They're in plain clothes, no badges visible, nothing. I said, I don't know for sure who they are. They could be anyone because there's no identification. And then she began asking for our identification. And I said, I don't recall you asking him for his identification. I don't know who he is. And why are you asking me for my identification when these people just tried to break into my friend's car? Eventually, my friend did show her identification. I chose not to. And the agents were then, when we left the law enforcement building, were like waiting, watching us leave. And I think that's about it.
Thank you. Appreciate you sharing your story with us, and I'm sorry that happened to you. Mr. Bueller, welcome to the committee. Please introduce yourself and begin.
Thank you, Chair Mueller, Chair Novotny, members of the committee. My name is John Bueller. I'm the policy counsel with the ACLU of Minnesota, testifying in support today of HF 3112 or 3412. Unmasked law enforcement has been the norm in this country as long as we've had law enforcement. Across various levels of government, across states, unmasked law enforcement is the standard. State troopers don't wear masks, neither do FBI agents. U.S. Marshals, sheriffs, judges, prosecutors, and politicians do not wear masks. In a recent opinion, one district court judge from West Virginia wrote that the presence of masked agents themselves constituted a constitutional violation. Some of his quotes: the overarching issue is whether the federal government may deploy anonymous agents to seize persons on American streets and highways for civil violations without warrants, without identification, and without any process before or after. The Constitution does not permit that. An anonymous government is no government at all. It cannot be held accountable. A masked agent freely uses force without justifying his actions, and the public cannot name him to challenge his conduct. Masks obscure government action and deprive the public of its Fourth Amendment protections. This policy has been supported by state and local law enforcement. It's also supported by parts of the federal government. The FBI issued a bulletin last year urging federal agencies to ensure that federal officers clearly identify themselves. The FBI pushed this policy to avoid the obvious outcome, that if law enforcement is masked, unidentifiable, and heavily armed, and that resisting arrest constitutes a crime, then individuals will take advantage of that public trust and that public fear. Criminals will wear masks, they will hide their identities, and they will carry weapons, and they will threaten potential victims with the perceived power of the state. This is not theoretical. The FBI bulletin cited at least 5 incidents, including burglary, kidnapping, and attempted rape, committed by people impersonating armed, masked federal agents. If these crimes continue, it will put us all in danger, including law enforcement officers, who people will no longer trust. The bill is compliant with federal law. California passed a similar bill with one crucial difference. It did not regulate state and local police. State and local laws are only invalid under the Intergovernmental Immunity Doctrine when the state law regulates the United States directly or discriminates against the federal government. Similarly, the Supremacy Clause immunity generally shields federal officers from state liability if the federal officer was doing something that was authorized by federal law and if the official's actions were necessary and proper in fulfilling their duties. Masked agents are not necessary or proper. We urge the committee to support HF 3412. Thank you.
All right. Thank you. Representative Ingen.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Question for the bill author. Do you know what the percentage increase is of assaults on ICE officers in the past year?
Representative Finke.
I do not.
It's 15. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Representative Ingen.
Sorry. Jump the gun. It's 1,500%. Do we know, do you happen to know the number increase of threats against ICE officers?
Representative Finke.
I don't know that. I do know the number of law enforcement agencies in America that consider wearing masks to be part of their duties. It is zero.
That wasn't my question.
Representative Ingen.
Thank you, Madam Chair. It's 8,000%. There are several instances in which ICE officers have been doxxed. They've been stalked, harassed, targeted. Violence was inflicted upon themselves and their families. In one instance in Portland, there were a couple of kids attending school who were being tracked down by protesters because their dad just so happened to be a federal officer. What I'm concerned about is that your bill here, it's actually going to put Minnesota into some legal liability. If that were to occur here, they could sue the state of Minnesota. Do you see that potentially with your bill as it currently stands?
Representative Finke.
I'm not sure I understand what you're saying. Because somebody was assaulted in Seattle, we would be able to be sued here if somebody was an ICE agent who had a mask on?
Representative Finke.
Thank you, Madam Chair. No, what I'm saying is that with this state law, they would now be working against what the federal standards are when it comes to face coverings, which could potentially open them up to some of these actions, whether it's stalking, doxing, violence, harassment. And then they could potentially sue the state of Minnesota for violation of the Supremacy Clause as well. Do you see that as a potential issue?
Representative Finke, and I'll just note, too, we have a number of members who want to talk. So if you can make your comments, too, without always asking us a question, too, that might actually help. Representative Finke.
Yes, I do not believe that will be a problem with this law. Doxing is illegal in the state of Minnesota. It is also very common for many of us. It is not related specifically to the essential duties of these agents in the state of Minnesota. These are crimes. These are crimes that would be pursued in the criminal justice system. And I have every faith that they would be pursued fairly.
Representative Ingen.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm talking about civil suit, not criminal. But beside the point, this is a there's numerous reasons why this bill will never become law. We know that. But this is ultimately a messaging bill. This isn't about protecting those officers who were trying to apprehend some of the most heinous people amongst us, whether it is child traffickers, whether it's murderers, rapists. There was a Hezbollah terrorist who was found here in Minneapolis. And ICE officers are being doxxed, assaulted, harassed. Opening them up to that and more of that is not, it's not a smart bill. So thank you so much.
You're welcome.
All right, Representative or Vice Chair Feist.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I just wanted to share some thoughts. When I think about my local law enforcement, I think about a relationship of trust. I know them. I know their faces. It's been really important to me to feel safe, especially over this last year, to know the people who are showing up at my door, you know, knowing them and their faces and their uniforms is really important. I've had the opportunity to be in the presence of a masked ICE agent, and it's really scary. Like, you feel it, like, viscerally. There is something about being in the presence of somebody with a weapon and a mask who's just staring at you. I wasn't doing anything. I was just in their presence, and, you know, it didn't make me feel safe. And I feel that when somebody goes into a law enforcement role and perceives their role as protecting public safety, they should want to do it in a way that makes the people in the community feel safe and feel that they can trust them and respect them. And I also think that if you're doing something that you believe in, that it's in the public good, like we all do here, you shouldn't feel the need to wear a mask. Like Representative Finke was saying, like, some of us have been doxxed. You know, we all bear that risk. You know, it's a conversation that we've had. You know, Representative Duran brought his bill relating to law enforcement. You know, it's a thing that we do when we believe in what we're doing, as we say that we believe in it publicly. And I just feel like wearing a mask, it's not a good sign that the people doing it believe and the work they're doing, and they're willing to stand up for it. And I just wanted to push back a bit on Representative Ingen's comments. You know, the people that I know have been detained by ICE, they are single moms, they're five-year-olds, they're retirees with, like, 30-year-old offenses. Like, you know, most people don't have any offenses. So I just wanted to make that comment. So thank you.
Representative Pinto.
Thank you, Madam Chair. A little bit different angle here. If we look at the bill, which I mean was always a good idea, if you look at the underlying language, the wearing a mask by a law enforcement officer right now is illegal. Yeah, I know. I can see one of my colleagues perplexed. Look at the bill. Look at the non-underlying language. That means the current law. If you conceal your identity by a mask, and it's not because of religious beliefs. I don't think that's happening with law enforcement officers. Incidental amusement, I don't think so, or entertainment, protection from weather. That's against the law. It's a crime right now. What this bill does is that it clarifies the circumstances under which it's not a crime. And if you look at the circumstances, they seem like extremely reasonable circumstances. So if my colleagues have a quibble with paragraphs B, with the exceptions, let's talk about that. If you want law enforcement officers to have circumstances when they can wear masks, then you will be not only voting for this bill, you'll be probably signing on to this bill to provide that clarity. We know that in addition to folks without documentation who were confronted by masked agents in the last month or two, it included people with legal status, U.S. citizens. It's easy to toss around a term like terrorist that was used right after the killings of Renee Good and Alex Preddy. This is a bill that will provide clarity and will provide exceptions for certain circumstances where law enforcement officers could wear masks. Otherwise, if you want to keep the law as it is and keep it illegal for law enforcement officers to wear masks, please vote against the bill. Thank you, Representative Finke.
Representative Duran.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And thank you, Rep. Pinto. I was a little concerned of where this was going because it actually exempts law enforcement federal agents here, but we're actually focused on federal agents. And I was just wondering where we're going to be focusing on, you know, the bill. And I just wanted us to refocus and wondering if there was an issue that state officers were doing that made this bill come about, or are we punishing our, you know, kind of almost punishing our state guys for the federal agencies? I mean, I don't know how this is going here. And that was just, that's a sincere, you know, question. So Go ahead.
Representative Pinky.
Yeah, that's a great question. I'm really grateful that you have it, because in the state of Minnesota right now, as Representative Pinto said, it is illegal for law enforcement to wear masks. That is illegal for law enforcement right now in the state of Minnesota. I feel like maybe people aren't aware of that. What we are doing is carving out the exemptions for state, local, and federal agents operating in the state of Minnesota when they can wear masks, because it is not essential to the duties of performing your law enforcement duties as a state or local officer to wear a face mask on duty. And we are saying, if you come into the state of Minnesota, you also have to follow that law, because it is not essential to your duties to wear a mask. I will just say, just totally bluntly, I know we are in a heated moment where discussion is kind of not favored. And I'm actually very cautious about discussion, because I just tried that once. But I actually think that the pro-law enforcement movement of people in this building should really support this. Right. If you want to be trusted when you are trying to find an individual that has committed a crime, you do not conceal yourself. And I think Representative Engen's comments are essential to understanding this, because we do not have this law. We do not allow this for state law enforcement. The FBI does not do it. No law enforcement agency in the country is allowed to cover their face except for one, and it is because of who they are arresting. The only distinction between immigration enforcement and every other law enforcement agency in America is that they are arresting immigrants. And so it seems to me to be the opinion that if you are going to terrorize immigrants, you can wear a mask and conceal your identity, and we can accept openly that everyone else deserves better.
Representative Hollins.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you, Representative Finke, for bringing this forward. You really just covered most of what I was going to say, but I was going to say this is it's so interesting to me that the last bill we just heard was bipartisan in nature, and this is just a continuation of that same idea, which is that we need to know who our law enforcement is, we need to build trust with them, and we need to have reliability in what that looks like. And when somebody shows up with a mask on their face or an unmarked car or with no identification, that is putting us in a less safe situation. It puts me in a situation where I don't know who that person is. And yes, maybe they are with ICE, maybe they're with DHS, but maybe they're just a random person who put a mask on and bought a little stickery thing that you can find on Amazon. I want to know who my law enforcement is. I have worked on building relationships with my police chief and with my sheriff, and, you know, for me, that was tricky, okay? And I think I deserve to know who is in my sheriff's office, who is a police officer in my police department. And when I go to the door, if they knock in the middle of the night, I would like them to have identification that is real and not have a mask covering their face. And I don't think that's asking too much. So I really appreciate you bringing this bill forward. And I can't help, since I started in 2020, thinking about how much we've discussed masks in this building since 2020, and how y'all were on the opposite side last time we had a conversation about masks. Let's remember, folks wanted a mask ban, and now we're saying, please don't put masks on our law enforcement. It's a reasonable ask, and I think everybody here should support it.
Representative Berg.
Thank you, Madam Chair. My remarks were similar to Representative Hollins. You know, the irony that you all sat over there and said in a bipartisan matter that you want your law enforcement identifiable, that the trust, the public trust in law enforcement was broken by the events that happened June 14th. You recall the perpetrator wore a different kind of mask, a full latex mask. And you sat there and talked about the public trust of some of you who have been police officers, that trust was broken, and then you want to defend this masked, untrained occupiers of our cities. And by the way, Representative Engen, no ICE officers have been harmed, but two American citizens have been murdered. Don't pretend they weren't. Thank you, Representative Finge, for bringing this bill.
Representative Hudson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I was trying to let this all go to a vote, but after those comments, I got a response. So, first of all, the difference between the two bills is pretty clear. One has to do with things that happen in this state under the purview and jurisdiction of this state. The other has to do with a policy that, once again, cannot be applied to the feds because we don't have that authority. I'll have to say it again, supremacy clause, it's a thing, it's real, it matters, which is why, in spite of the fact that you just pointed out that wearing a mask is already illegal, strangely enough, ICE is wearing masks. How'd that happen?
Because they're breaking law.
Oh, and oh, so who's enforcing that? And by the way, here's a question for the author. How does this get enforced? Who's going to arrest federal agents for breaking your law?
Representative Finke.
I'd like to ask my testifier to answer.
Mr. Buehler.
Chair Mueller, Representative Hudson, we expect the law enforcement of the state of Minnesota to uphold their oaths and enforce the laws of the state. Thank you.
Representative Hudson.
Thank you very much. So there you have it. This bill pits state and local law enforcement against federal law enforcement. Boy, that sounds healthy. That's going to have some great outcomes, isn't it? Law enforcement fighting law enforcement in the street looks an awful lot like a civil war, doesn't it? So here's the deal. You want to talk about trust? I found it very enlightening, even though it was on a completely different topic, when Representative Bonner was talking about the trust that she has in her local law enforcement and how important that is, how essential it is, and we all agree it's incredibly important. But when you actively undermine that public trust in federal law enforcement by saying they're pretending to be law enforcement, no, they're not. They're officers of federal law. When you say they're invading, when you say it's an occupation, when you say they're kidnapping people, this rhetoric is irresponsible, and it undermines public trust. And then, and that's on the rhetoric side. On the policy side, no cooperation at the state or local level with federal law enforcement. That is the heart of all of these issues. This issue, this bill we heard from Long this morning, where we need to create a new civil cause of action that's completely unenforceable. This bill that's completely unenforceable. Oh, we've got to address the trauma of the kids. All of which was created by your choice to not uphold federal law, which is your constitutional responsibility. This is not happening in other states because they're cooperating with federal law enforcement. Nothing you've been complaining about this entire interim or so far this session would have happened if you let state and local law enforcement do their damn job.
We're going to move to, I think, Representative Novotny, and then we'll let you close if you wanted to respond. Yeah.
Thank you, Chair Mueller. I'd like to point out the side, and I could be wrong. I believe Representative Hollins is a lawyer, and Representative Pinto is a lawyer, who have argued on both sides of this bill. I could be wrong, Representative Pinto, but I think you were implying that Section B from line 112 says that this does not apply to law enforcement officers. No? So you're saying that a law enforcement officer in a tactical situation can wear a mask? I'll sum up with this because this will make it really simple. Especially concerning is line 1.17, a member of a tactical response unit when a mask will substantially reduce the known risk of a serious permanent disfigurement of the officer's face. Well, as a former tactical officer who did dozens and dozens of meth labs, I would appreciate that. But you know what that doesn't cover? That doesn't cover the three times that I've gassed a house to go in and get a suspect on either a murder arrest or threatening with the weapon arrest, because that wouldn't cover you for an officer's face. I don't think this is very well thought out. I don't think that this will solve anything, and I recommend a no vote.
Madam Chair.
Vice Chair Vice.
I would like a roll call, please.
A roll call has been requested. Before you go to your closing remarks, Representative Finke, I just want to say I have talked to numerous law enforcement officers about the way ICE and CBP have been operating in our state, and they have been appalled at the behavior. It is not like the training they received. It is undermining public trust and safety in our communities, particularly the way they are not identifying themselves. They are masked. I hear from my officers and deputies that it's important for them not to mask. Chair Novotny, there is on line 1.110 protection from smoke, gas, or other airborne toxin as a reason to wear a mask. And so I'm a strong supporter of this bill, and I'm looking forward to your closing remarks, Representative Finke.
Thank you, Chair Mueller and committee, for once again a robust debate on the bill. I do want to just thank you for pointing out the exemption. Representative Novotny, Chair Novotny, the exact thing that you call out is covered in this bill. There are many things that people can say about me, but one of the things that I do take offense to is that I don't think through my bills. I worked very hard on this bill with our House research. I started working on this bill last summer when ICE was in Los Angeles. This is not a thoughtless bill. This is not a messaging bill. This is a piece of serious legislation. I have been talking to our law enforcement about it. I know, back up what Mueller just said, Chair Mueller said about the support that we have from people and understanding that law enforcement cannot conduct itself in the state of Minnesota in the way that we have seen. I've put a lot of thought into this bill. So just please don't disregard hard work by our staff, by our testifiers, by so many people who are trying to improve the state of Minnesota. I also just will close by saying, Representative Hudson, I'm sorry, but that is not correct. We are not powerless to regulate the federal officials in the state of Minnesota because of the Supremacy Clause. The Supremacy Clause means that we cannot regulate different governments differently and that essential duties to perform the job cannot be regulated. It is not that we can do nothing. We, as a state in a system of states, have authority. Somehow we have flipped the switch here where suddenly, you know, the Democrats are here saying the states have authority to defend ourselves against overreach of federal government. But the Supremacy Clause is not a catch-all for any action. As long as we are regulating all governments equally and allowing them to do the essential duties of their job, I believe this is good policy. It is not reactionary policy. And I hope that you will vote yes.
I renew the motion to recommend that House File 3412 be placed on the general register. The clerk will take the roll.
Chair Mueller.
Aye.
Chair Mueller, aye. Chair Novotny.
No.
Chair Novotny, no. Vice Chair Feist.
Aye.
Vice Chair Feist, aye. Vice Chair Witte.
No.
Vice Chair Witte, no. Representative Berg.
Aye.
Representative Berg, aye. Representative Bliss.
No.
Representative Bliss, no. Representative Curran.
Aye.
Representative Curran, aye. Representative Duran.
No.
Representative Duran, no. Representative Engen.
No.
Representative Engen, no. Representative Greenman.
Aye.
Representative Greenman, aye. Representative Harder.
No.
Representative Harder, no. Representative Hollins.
Aye.
Representative Hollins, aye. Representative Hudson.
No.
Representative Hudson, no. Representative Johnson.
Aye.
Representative Johnson, aye. Representative Pinto.
Aye.
Representative Pinto, aye. Representative Ream.
Ream, aye.
Representative Ream, aye. Representative Rapinski.
Rapinski, no.
Representative Rapinski, no. Representative Schwartz.
No.
Representative Schwartz, no. Representative Steer.
No.
Representative Steer, no. Representative Tabke.
Aye.
Representative Tabke votes aye. There are 10 ayes and 10 nays.
There being 10 ayes and 10 nays, the motion does not prevail. Thank you, Representative Finke. Members, seeing that we are past time, the agenda was ambitious. We will hold my bill over House File 3405 to another hearing. And so with that, we are adjourned.